different organisation, but maybe because there's also different organisational hats and issues in me. But I always find coming here and talking to you is really refreshing and kind of challenging to me, because you always have such good questions. So I've tried to be brief. It's a bit difficult because there's a lot to say. But I'll maybe try and be a bit restrained and then elaborate more in the discussion when it's clear what you want to go into more detail on, particularly on the role of labour. That needs more detail to probe in the discussion. But I've already had a sort of whiff of some of the questions, because even as I was waking up from a rather jet-lagged night at breakfast, I was being questioned by Abby Shine here and Leah, and then later on at lunch by Sam Gindin. And so I'm sort of half prepared, although I am still a bit jet-lagged. Anyway, also it's great to share a platform with Doug, who I've always been a fan of, and particularly somebody who's been commenting and observing so perceptively, the Bernie Sanders campaign, which I must say was a big inspiration for us and the Corbyn supporters. I mean, it did seem to us to be pretty socialist, certainly anti-capitalist, anti-Wall Street, and, you know, sometimes people say, actually, he's more socialist than Jeremy Corbyn. I don't think that's true, but, well, we don't have a competition, but, you know, it's certainly a movement like that in the belly of the beast really gave a lot of confidence to us at a time when, you know, Jeremy was always under attack and so on. And then finally, when it came to the election campaign, these droves of Sanders people, maybe they were just needing to carry on, came over. You know, several stayed in my rather small house, and so night after night we were talking about it. But what the main thing they were doing is having very organised schools with Momentum and Labour Party activists, really, really training them, working with them on the kind of radical campaigning that was so important in building up Bernie's momentum. And that was really important because, as I'll talk about later, the problem with the Labour Party, and this is the big problem, you know, it's like, okay, Jeremy Corbyn won the leadership and did so well in the election, but can the Labour Party be changed? And I want to argue this isn't just a question of winning positions, it's actually a matter of completely unravelling an institution. And in that, one part of the institution that's been so inhibiting and so damaging for the left is the way in which it's taken working class votes for granted. So at election time, what people do, they don't go out and argue and campaign, God forbid, arguing, you know, challenging the consensus. No, it's not about that, it's about going out to mainly the working class estates and just finding out which house is going to vote Labour, writing it down on a sort of form, it's got some name, I can't remember. And then going back to sort of headquarters and telling people how many and who and do they need a lift on election day. And I remember doing this canvassing in Hackney, and I was told, look, you're spending too much time arguing with people. You know, because that's what you know, as a political person, you want to argue with people who are a little bit, you know, shaky and who they're voting for. But anyway, Bernie's organisers were saying, this is what you've got to do. You've got to go out there and actually persuade people and take Jeremy's arguments, take this very, you know, socialist manifesto and persuade people and stay on the doorstep until people are persuaded. And that's what really did have an impact, because you had so many different levels of the campaign. You had Jeremy Corbyn himself, who for once was given a regular platform on the media, because election rules require the opposition to have, you know, the same amount of time. And Theresa May refused to debate. I mean, she really doesn't want to anything to do with the people. So she said, I'm not going to debate, I'm not going to have any public debates. So in a way, Corbyn had the stage to himself. And so he became more and more sort of confident and was able to articulate and explain the manifesto that was, you know, a really good process of involving the unions. They particularly were involved in that, and it was very committed, particularly on public ownership, which there's a lot of support, majority support for almost, you know, bringing back into common public ownership all the major utilities. And so there was that level. Then there was the Momentum, which is an organisation I'll say something more about, which is basically a consolidation of the support for Corbyn into a movement, which is both a movement to change the Labour Party, a movement to win a left government, a Corbyn government, and a movement to change society. So it's it's full of complications and tensions and so on, but it's a very important sort of movement. So they were arguing, they were adopting the Bernie campaign tactic and going out day after day very confidently, because it soon became very clear that that there was a sort of, you know, a groundswell of support for Corbyn and a rejection of neoliberal policies. And we began to sense that. Meanwhile, the Labour Party was telling us, you know, because they, right until the last day, they believed, the apparatus believed that Corbyn was a complete liability and they weren't going to, they were going to do really badly. And the problem was even existing MPs might lose their seats. So we were told we had to go and campaign for all these dreadful MPs who'd been organising against Corbyn, you know, because their majorities were under threat. And we said, no, we think we could actually win a few Tory seats. So we went to a place a bit like where the dreadful human tragedy in Grenfell Tower took place, just opposite there, Battersea. And we turned what had been a Tory majority of 5,000 into a Labour majority of around about 6,000. And that's what was happening all the time. Anyway, partly because of this day-to-day talking to people on the doorstep campaigning. Anyway, so what I want to talk about really is, well, obviously there are a lot of differences between us and the Labour Senators campaign, although there are a lot of similarities too, particularly in terms of the enthusiasm of young people. But I suppose one of the differences is that we're now facing the possibility of government. I won't say power, but at least of government. And that raises a whole lot of dilemmas that I think we should talk about in the discussion. And secondly, we're working, I'd say, in and against a Labour Party, you know, an actual Labour Party that has an explicitly socialist constitution that hasn't ever borne much relation to what it's done in government. And as Ralph Miliband put it, you know, the Labour Party is more dogmatic about Parliament and parliamentary socialism, actually, he called it, but Parliament anyway, than it is about socialism. But there's always been, as I've argued, as it were, two parties in the Labour Party. So, in a way, Jeremy's campaign, as I'll try and argue, is in this peculiar position of being coming from outside the party, but yet expressed within it and building on the sort of socialist traditions inside it. So what I want to do is firstly explain how come, I mean, a bit like the Bernie Sanders movement, it seemed to come from nowhere. You know, how did this happen? At a time when the left was really almost seemed in the Labour Party completely, you know, dead, really completely defunct. You know, its meetings were about three MPs, you know, it would have a few meetings around the country, but it really, there seemed no life in it. So how did suddenly this movement, stronger than any other kind of left movement inside or associated with the Labour Party, how did that come about? And then I want to go into this whole idea of the sort of unravelling of the Labour Party as it's historically been and the key sort of assumptions on which its institutions are based. Because I think that's really what has to happen, and that my argument would be that actually this unravelling has gone so far, but actually the remaining taboos and inhibitions that come from the origins of the Labour Party towards the British state, towards the relationship between the party and the unions, politics and economics, insofar as they remain, in a sense the Labour Party will strangle the possibilities of the changes led by Jeremy Corbyn, because he does not have control over the party. We saw that last summer when, you know, the MPs, more than half of them revolted against him, and with the support of the apparatus, which is still dominated by people appointed by Tony Blair, and was consciously working against him at the last party conference when they still had a considerable hold on the delegates. You know, they were actually organising against the leader, against Jeremy Corbyn. This time, they just didn't have that possibility because momentum is so well organised. But anyway, let's get on with first explaining this extraordinary. A lot of people dismiss it as an accident and in a way use this against Corbyn, sort of implying, you know, he wasn't prepared, it's all a bit completely contingent, it's not rooted on in anything, it's not going to last. And so on. Now, I'd say that, well, I'll just, that's I'll just go into that. I mean, I think that, that in a sense, what is contingent is the fact that he was there as the voice of what are, I think, quite historical kind of tendencies. So the main sort of forces or tendencies that produce this surge, as people describe it, this extraordinary movement, were not, in a way, primarily inside the Labour Party, because by 2015, the Labour Party, as any kind of organisation of political vibrancy, debate, ideas, let alone socialism, had been almost completely killed by Tony Blair. I mean, his whole project had been to kill the idea of debate, the idea of politics. You know, he created an apolitical, sort of political culture in which any kind of debate, any kind of talk of the left or socialism was completely taboo. And so there were a few people hanging on in there, just partly because they felt, you know, why should we hand over the party to him, you know, by leaving? So there were a few people like that who were just determined to hang on. And then there were just thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who'd been in the Labour Party, you know, been really, you know, come from Labour families, were like real stalwarts, but just could not take it anymore, particularly after the Iraq War, but also with privatisation and, you know, the way in which Tony Blair was positively enthusiastic about privatisation and completely contemptuous of public servants and the public sector. So there was that kind of force, which included in, but even this large number of people who were outside had been in. And then the other significant source of support was the whole kind of new generation of young people radicalised by both the sort of inequalities and injustice caused by neoliberalism, by, you know, decades of neoliberalism in Britain, Thatcher and then Blair, and who'd also been let down by the Liberal Party, the Lib Dems, who promised, you know, there'd be no student loans and so on, but then just capitulated to the Tories. So they were just at their kind of, you know, their limits of what they could accept politically, but they were still very radical, very idealistic, and very angry with the injustice they could see around them. And so they took to direct action in a very imaginative kind of way. So you've probably heard about UK Uncut, which was a movement that, you know, was reacting to the tax evasion, to the gross inequalities, particularly in the city amongst corporate bosses and so on. And they just occupied the shops, the front, you know, Boots, Vodafone, all these different sort of shop windows of companies that were evading tax, and turned Boots into a hospital for a day. You know, just very dramatic actions that got lots of both local publicity and national publicity, and turned the campaign against tax evasion from a little group of one or two MPs and a few experts into a mass movement. And then climate camp that just again occupied areas near Heathrow against the expansion of Heathrow, and again took direct action. So this was another kind of movement very much from outside. And then you have the trade union movement, the trade unionists, who'd just again been radicalised firstly by you know, a deep anger against Thatcher. I think that was again expressed in the Brexit vote, particularly in the north. We can discuss Brexit in more detail in the discussion. But those trade unionists radicalised by both Thatcher and then by Blair, and in a way, they were able to have a voice individually. I mean, some of their leaders, who they'd elected, were also on the left, but there was a great mass of radical trade unionists who were often active at a local level, fighting privatisation, and fighting privatisation with an alternative, you know, sort of democratic public services. They took politics into their own hands, breaking that division between politics and trade unionism, which was so basic to the Labour Party. There was been a rule change in the Labour Party whereby, although traditionally it's always been the bloc vote, the unions as a bloc voting on who should be the leader as part of a college, an electoral college in which the MPs had a big say. And as a result of various both pressures and of different kinds, there was a rule change that gave trade unionists an individual vote. Although that appeared to come from the right, it was actually accepted partly because of a belief that, in a way, the block vote was undemocratic and didn't allow the individual trade unionists to have sufficient say. So in a way, this rule change, which was supported by the right, actually gave great support to Jeremy, because trade unionists could join the Labour Party for like £3 individually and then exercise their vote, which is what happened on a huge scale. So these different kind of forces, they, in a way, they looked at Corbyn once he got onto the ballot, which was a very precarious and almost accidental process, but not entirely, because those sort of people actually lobbied, put pressure on their MPs to sign support for him on the electoral ballot, the parliamentary ballot. So he got there, and then it became like a sort of conductor, a sort of lightning conductor or sort of magnet, in which gradually, as the momentum grew, initially from the disillusioned Labour Party people, but they then sort of led to lots of mass meetings, which then young people saw. Here's an MP who isn't a parliamentarist, you know, who's been supporting struggles for the last 40 years and who's standing up for their concerns, particularly around student loans and so on. And they were just, you know, they'd climb in through windows, they'd get into those meetings any way they could. So it became a mass movement driven from energies outside. And I think this is very important in understanding this process of sort of unravelling of the institutions, which I'm not going to be able to expand on, but I should just make the sort of main points. So, I mean, I think the key problems that have, in a way, been inhibitions on the Labour left, because the Labour left have accepted, right from the beginning, from the ILP and the founding of the Labour Party, these constraints. The first is a kind of descriptively, I mean a kind of presumption that it's going to be the state that's going to deliver socialism, that really ordinary working class people don't have that capacity to creatively construct socialism. It's a matter of a well-planned sort of state. So I've probably read it before at meetings here, but you know, you have Beatrice Webb, the Fabian, one of the leader of the Fabians, that was a key architect of both the Labour Party's constitution and many of its policies, actually saying very explicitly that she didn't believe that the ordinary essential man, as she put it, he could simply describe his problems. He couldn't provide alternatives or solutions, and therefore we had to introduce the expert. And then Stafford Cripps, who was on the left, I mean, Beatrice was just a sort of, you know, right-wing intellectual supporting the Labour Party and constructing its policies in many ways. But Stafford Cripps in 1946, when he was president of the Board of Trade, he was kind of so far left that he was expelled, although it didn't take much to expel people on the left from the Labour Party. But anyway, he was expelled for supporting the Communist Party and so on. And he said after 1945, 1946, you had a war in which working class people, particularly in production, had really almost organised production, had challenged management who were not sufficiently, you know, effective in providing for the war effort. So there was a whole kind of reality of workers' control. But he said, I can't actually find my historical quotes, but effectively he said that there aren't enough people, aren't enough working people who could run industry, and that working class people don't have the capacity to run industry. So he was dismissing that idea of workers' control. And I think, Leo can correct me, but I think some of the tensions between Michael Foot and Tony Benn, whereas Tony Benn had been radicalised by shop stewards and the occupation of the Upper Clyde shipbuilding, and was kind of, in a way, seeing the energy of working class people as the basis of an alternative industrial policy. Michael Foot was quite sort of dismissive. He believed in public ownership, but he never took seriously the other commitment in the constitution, which was to to popular administration of the nationalised industries. He never really took that sort of seriously. So he rather found Tony Benn's dealing with shop stewards, you know, all the messiness of workers' control, a bit beyond his kind of vision. So that was one key sort of presumption. And I think the opposite, you know, the opposite of that is visible in Jeremy Corbyn. His whole stance is one of a belief in working class people. I mean, Leo and I interviewed him, and he said he's not of, he doesn't have any deference towards people who've got higher education, or no sense of superiority to those who haven't. He said, life is life, and the wisest people are cleaning our streets. And that was visible at the party conference, where he was constantly talking about, you know, not what we will do in government, but also how the key thing is to release and to help to organise the creativity of working people. And John McDonnell, in his very impressive speech about the left in government, you know, at the end, called on people to begin to organise that popular participation. I mean, this leads to huge problems with the unions. You know, are the unions organised enough, political enough, to be the basis of that popular participation? And this is the other, in a way, presumption and institutional constraint that needs to be and is being unravelled, but I don't think sufficiently, which is this division between politics and trade unionism, which is absolutely fundamental to the constitution of the Labour Party, that the unions are concerned with industrial relations, wages and conditions, but all political issues are delegated to the Labour Party. You know, and the idea of the unions becoming political, or the left becoming working with the unions, is completely, you know, taboo, and has been, particularly after the defeat of the general strike in 1926. But it's a tradition which has carried on right into the 50s. In a way, Tony Benn's relationship with unions was the first break in that, maybe a bit before, Leo was reminding me, with C&D and the kind of involvement with social movements by the Labour left. But on the whole, the Labour left has accepted that division, and in a way its alliance with trade union leaders has been based on that sort of almost deference to trade unionism being a sphere that they shouldn't interfere in. I mean, there have been important movements like the Movement for Workers' Control that did organise politically trade unionists, but that was very much the exception. But that kind of experience, led by Tony Benn and others, Ken Coates and so on, I think was an important formative experience for Jeremy Corbyn, who is trying to connect with the unions. And some of the unions are becoming much more political, but that's a very, I'd say it's quite a subordinate trend. We can talk more in the discussion. I think the other key taboo is around the state, you know, that again, particularly in Ralph's book, it's very clear that the Labour Party, right from its origins, always presumed that it would use the present state. Actually, it's just lack of water that would stop me speaking. So maybe you should deprive them. But you know, the deference towards the monarchy, you know, the whole when Jeremy Corbyn wasn't fully articulating the national anthem, whatever it's called, the Queen, the sort of homage to the Queen, at some do. You know, he was like pilloried, and not just by, you know, reactionary Daily Telegraph or Times readers, but by MPs, by Guardian editorials. You know, this is disgusting. How can he call himself future Prime Minister? He can't actually sing the national anthem, you know, which is just a sort of, you know, God save the Queen, but also, you know. I mean, so it's nothing about the country, the people. So that whole sort of deference to the state, that whole refusal to think about either constitutional reform or even, just as important, reform of public administration, is complete anathema to both the party leaderships in the past and the left. And that includes deference to Britain's military role. You know, there was Michael Foote supporting the Falklands War almost as energetically as Margaret Thatcher. And now Jeremy's break from that is, again, it's one of these, it's an incomplete unravelling. I mean, he's been very strong historically around the Britain's military role. And he's personally made it clear that he's against Trident and personally against NATO. But some of his allies are saying, no, we must challenge capital, but they must keep their toys, i.e. NATO and the weapons and so on. So there's a sort of, and in his manifesto, he didn't come out wasn't his, it was the party manifesto, so party policy is still supportive of Trident or not you know, really going down the road of looking at alternatives in terms of production and so on. So, you know, that's an unfinished task. So I'm going to have to wind up. So I think one of my arguments is that this unravelling is incomplete, but the important thing is that it's not just about Jeremy Corbyn. He's unleashed and given political confidence to a far wider movement, which is both old and, you know, it's both people rejoining the party in their 50s and 60s, and a whole new generation of young people. And it's that force, really, that's what's going to complete the unravelling. And Corbyn is in support of it and has never sort of backed off that. And he was very clear. I mean, the other thing is parliamentarism itself, that when he was under challenge last year, and it must have been a pretty appalling thing. I mean, I know people who went to the, who were involved in the friend of mine is in the House of Lords, she had to go to the parliamentary meetings, and she said it was absolutely awful. You know, they'd be personally abusing him and so on, but he stuck it out because, you know, he knew he had all this extra parliamentary support, but that's what the MPs couldn't bear. MPs are very precious about their position. I mean, it links to the monarchy. They feel, they make this oath to the Queen, and they almost feel they are kind of a brand of royalty. You know, they expect people to look up to them, and, you know, and so when, you know, when you've got all these young people, these members, who are challenging them and even questioning maybe, you know, re-selection and challenging them at AGMs and constituency meetings, it's very, very uncomfortable, and they blame Jeremy. And so he has broken that taboo. He's got absolutely no inhibition at all about being involved in extra parliamentary movements and supporting Momentum and the young people. And this last Labour Party conference illustrated that. I mean, there was a big festival organised almost parallel with the main conference, but it wasn't like an alternative. And in the past, all this extra parliamentary campaigning has been treated as just the fringe. Whereas this time, you know, everybody, you had to wear a special armband if you went to the festival. And the delegates were mostly wearing these armbands. And so the two, the sort of extra parliamentary and the parliamentary, were completely fused. So that's a source of hope. And I think it does point to a strategy that isn't just, as I said at the beginning, about winning positions, but it's quite a complex hybrid of carrying on keeping positions, but using those to turn the Labour Party into itself some kind of movement, which was the original hope when it was created, the hope of the Independent Labour Party. And, you know, there was a real fusion at the beginning of trades councils and the Labour Party, which has been broken historically, but is maybe going to come back. But anyway, I'm looking forward to questions. I'll say more, and I'm really sorry.